Morning, everyone. Week four, we keep going in the traveling the journey of this month and next month, month of Elul, month of Tishrei. What I want to do is just quickly sort of summarize the first 3 weeks because that'll give a bit of a context to what we're doing today. So far we've covered. By the way, thank you. Those who were there at the other night of the journey, it was beautiful to see you. I'm just mentioning it because really what we're doing on Thursday morning is a bit of a broader version of what we did that night. That night it was intense and capsule-packed, but we're unpacking it a bit here. So, okay. So, we started off with the month of Elul. We're talking about change, improvement, growing. Month of Elul is the month of reflection, becoming aware, as we spoke about the first time, reflecting honestly, sometimes leading to becoming a little bit uncomfortable, which is fine, and even unsettled. Not finding only the bad, but sort of focusing and not fixing necessarily anything that we come up with, but it's really just to create a focus and to create the awareness that although there are things we need to fix, but step one is to focus on the now, focus on the present. And to learn to let go of the past, not completely because we obviously learn from the past, but to make sure it doesn't trap us and define us, as we spoke. Now, we explained the second week, the purpose of unsettling ourselves a little bit during the month of Elul is to strip away the conscious self in order to reveal the real self, which is something we do particularly with great emphasis on Rosh Hashanah. That's the idea of the shofar. The shofar is to that cry coming from the depth of who we are, the core essence, the core innocence, the core purity of who we are, the part of us that never failed, never sinned, never was broken. And that's the foundation of our purity, which we start with in Rosh Hashanah, connecting to God in a very deep way, particularly through the shofar, in order to repair and rebuild from that point of complete purity, the point where we didn't fail, the wholeness of us, the real self. That's where we start and we rebuild. Now, last week we also talked about guilt, and we talked about that the process of this, even though it sometimes makes us, it's confronting, it's a confronting process, which is the only way to really implement growth, but it's not a confronting process to create guilt. On the contrary, guilt is negative. This is more about the feeling of discomfort to create urgency, to make sure that we are controlling the process, even the guilt, but not it controlling us, because then it becomes destructive and obsessive. And of course, the whole purpose of it is not to despair and to give up, but the purpose is to reveal that part of us that is still whole and still amazingly connected, which of course is a source of joy. And therefore, tshuva, the whole process of tshuva, although it is a process of, it's a confronting process, but nevertheless, it does come together with a certain joy, an inner joy, at having the gift, at having the opportunity to be able to repair and rebuild, no matter how many times you might have failed, but giving us the opportunity to always reconnect and always reveal the part of us that is still whole and still pure. And before we get into today, sorry, if you want to hand out, there's one right there on the fat hill. Just Nechama normally gives them out, isn't here today, so. Yeah. Before we go into what I'm doing today, I want to just, as I've been doing at this time of the year, I always do this because there's a lot of stuff happening. So just break for a commercial. First of all, there's one more week of the series. And then we're going to break over the festival period, over the Chagim. However, we do have one during Sukkot, as we always do, but not here. We have one in my Sukkah, 52 Anglesey Street. And it will take place this year on a Thursday as well, which is handy. Because the way the Chagim are structured, that we can do the Thursday morning. At my Sukkah, 52 Anglesey Street. It'll be on the 5th of October, just so you can put it in your diary. But it won't be at 9:20, it'll be at 10 o'clock. Just because of that time of the year of Sukkot, we have longer prayers in the morning. And so it'll be at 10 o'clock at my house, obviously with a tea, to fulfill the mitzvah of eating in the Sukkah and being in the Sukkah. And we'll have a lecture discussing some of the lessons we learned from Sukkot and so on, as we always do. That's the 5th of October at 10 o'clock, my Sukkah at home, 52 Anglesey Street. While I'm talking about that, also just to mention again, I mean, I'll put it out on all the WhatsApps and the emails and so on, those that are interested. I'm doing a special service at Rosh Hashanah in Vaucluse, as I mentioned last week. On the second day, Rosh Hashanah, that's the 17th of September, 10 o'clock, we'll be with a Kiddush, but also more of an explanatory service with insights, meditation, and so on. And then stay tuned for everything else that's happening around this time of the year. Okay, so once we finish with Rosh Hashanah, not once we finish, I'm saying once we experience Rosh Hashanah, better said, we move into the period leading up to Yom Kippur, but that period is, as I mentioned the other night, the period is called Aseret Yimei Teshuva, the 10 days of Teshuva. Right? Now, the point of this is, it's the time to make, it's now in that journey of change, it's now the time to make a practical plan for the coming year, right? It's time to take responsibility for those things that are, do live in our conscious self, and to take the next step. But here's the important part. As we've been explaining, this only becomes possible, and that's what only happens after the Rosh Hashanah idea. In other words, first we need to expose the real self to do two things, right? We need to first understand that the real identity of who we are is pure, remains pure, and therefore has the godly infusion of infinity, which makes our potential so much greater than we think it is, and therefore gives us the ability to actually grow because we're not defined by our failings. That's why we can fix them. And that's why we can improve them, and that's why we can continue to grow. And also, it gives us, once we've understood the two parts of our existence and our experience, and we've exposed, in the Rosh Hashanah idea, we exposed that true self, it gives us much greater scope, as we started talking about last week, to take responsibility. Because, as we explained last week, the mistakes that we make are not who we are, but they're ours. In other words, we need to own them completely. We need to take responsibility for them. And because they're not us, we just own them. We, the real we, can take responsibility for those mistakes and really work on them and try to do a better job in the coming year. But here's the important part. The process of real change and effective change and practical change does not mean we fix everything, right? Because no one can do that. No one can go into Yom Kippur and say, I'm coming out of Yom Kippur, the tzaddik of the generation. No one's doing that, okay? Unless the tzaddik of the generation. But I don't think it includes anyone here, nor me. So we're just regular people, so it can't mean that, right? It means taking a step forward, that's what it means. But it does mean, and that's why these things are not contradictory, and I want to just highlight this because it's not always understood. It does mean being honest about everything and taking responsibility for everything and then doing what we can, realistically. There's a sort of a trend in today's society that people like to be perfect. People don't like to be told they're imperfect, right? Because it kind of... And I think part of that is because people define themselves by their conscious self. I think that's part of it, right? So if I define myself by my conscious self, then I can't be imperfect because then I'm bad, right? So if I have a weakness, if I have a personality weakness, and that's me, then I'm bad. And that's a problem. In Judaism, it doesn't work like that. We don't need to be perfect, and it's fine. We don't need to be perfect. But we need to know that we're not perfect. And we need to take responsibility for everything that we do and say, I'm doing my best. I'm trying. I'm pushing myself. It's like fitness, right? Or it's like any physical health program. No one's going to achieve it in one day, but we need to know the goal and work towards that. Pushing ourselves, yes. Going out of our comfort zone, yes. But not finishing the job, right? And this is such a fundamental concept in Judaism. We find this many times. It's like I told you the whole story about that person last week with the four excuses, right? But we find that many times, this theme, right? We know that one of the biggest problems, one of the biggest failings, the first failings in the world, was the sin of Adam and Eve, right? But the real sin was not that they ate from the fruit. I mean, it was. They weren't supposed to. God told them not to, and they did. You know what the real sin was? That they didn't take responsibility. Adam blamed Eve, and Eve blamed the snake. That's it. As soon as that happens, boom. God's not happy. And then he went into the whole thing about what's going to happen with them and so on, right? What's the contrast there? King David. King David, the Tanakh said he sinned. Now, I just need to pause here. Of course, King David was on a whole different level than we are. And the Kabbalists and the Talmud really explains that when we read about King David's sin, it's important to read it in context of commentary and both halachically and spiritually and Kabbalistically. It's not the sin as it seems to be in the reading of the Tanakh, but nevertheless, on his level, it was considered a sin. Okay? I mean, that's a whole other shiur one day. Maybe we'll do that. It's a fascinating discussion about what actually happened there with King David and Bathsheba and so on. why did it happen and how come he was still a tzaddik and how come, all that kind of stuff, right? Okay. But nevertheless, God did think that on his level at least, he had something lacking. He was doing something wrong. And he did something, he did whatever he did, and then he was confronted by the prophet Natan HaNavi. And the whole thing, Natan HaNavi came and he gave him a parable and he broke to him slowly. And eventually he breaks to him and says, you know, you are the man, you have sinned, he tells King David. And what's King David's response? One word. Chatati, I have sinned. I take responsibility. You're right. That's one of the most important things in Judaism. We're not perfect. God didn't design perfect. We make mistakes. We fail. But just acknowledge it. Acknowledge we're not perfect. If someone has a problem, they get angry from time to time, acknowledge it. If we have a problem with jealousy, acknowledge it. If we're not up to doing a particular mitzvah, we acknowledge it, right? And say, well, okay, now I'm gonna put in a plan. It's not gonna be, I'm not gonna fix the whole thing, not this year at least, but I'm gonna move towards it, right? And that's that move in the right direction when someone has confronted. So two things happen at once. In other words, we have the month of Elul when we take stock honestly, and we understand both our strengths and all of our weaknesses, and we own all of them. But people sometimes are scared to do that because they think if I own all of them, that means I have to change all of them. That's too overwhelming. The answer is you don't have to change all of them. You have to take one step in the direction of changing. But you do have to own them. Very different. Is that clear? Yeah? I'm going to share with you just on that note a very beautiful idea that Lubavitch Rebbe once explained in a passage in the Mishnah. There's a section of the Talmud that talks about Yom Kippur and talks about the idea of tshuva. This idea of reconnection and improvement and fixing and repairing and so on. And it's a saying from Rabbi Akiva, the famous Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva quotes a pasuk, he quotes a verse. He starts off by saying how lucky we are, how fortunate we are to have the gift of tshuva, right? And to have Yom Kippur and the opportunity that God gives us to atone and to be purified and to come out with a clean slate and be forgiven and so on and so forth. Rabbi Akiva says, Ashreichem Yisrael, happy are you, fortunate are you Israel. Look at, you know, my brothers and sisters, he's saying, look how fortunate you are, you have this gift called Yom Kippur. Lifnei mi atem etarin, think about it, before whom you are becoming purified. Right? Before God himself, God is doing the purification. And then he says, you know, that there's a pasuk, there's a verse where God is compared to a mikveh. A mikveh is a pool of water where today we don't have this idea so much because we don't have the Beit HaMikdash, the temple laws. So we don't have all the laws of purity and impurity the way it used to be in the times of the temple, where if you became, in Jewish law, there are all sorts of types of impurity and types of things that are different levels that you need a mikveh to purify. Otherwise you can't go to the Beit HaMikdash and you couldn't eat sacrificial meat. A lot of these laws don't apply today. Of course, we still have women who go to mikveh every month, but then many people go to mikveh just for purification purposes before Shabbat, before festivals. Okay, but it's a little bit different today. But nevertheless, he says that God is called a mikveh. Why? So listen carefully to his words. He says, "Ma mikveh, just like a mikveh, metaher et hatemeim, just like a mikveh purifies the impure." Right. So too, God purifies the Jewish people. Okay. And that's his statement to show the power of the purification process of Yom Kippur. So the Rebbe asked the following question on this. First of all, what's this amazing statement? I mean, it's a verse. The verse says that God is like a mikveh, so we can work it out ourselves. We don't need Rabbi Akiva to tell us this, right? We can see that if the God compares God to a mikveh, that means God is purifying us, just like a mikveh does. Right? Just like when you immerse in a mikveh, you become purified, it's transformative. So too, God does the same thing for us. He purifies us in a very transformational way. Why do I need Rabbi Akiva to say that? And he explained the following. He said, look carefully at the words. He says, just like a mikveh purifies those that are impure, as if to say, the simple reading of this, it's a bit complicated, but the simple reading of this is, just like a mikveh takes someone impure and makes them pure, right? But it's actually not what the sentence says. The sentence says, just like a mikveh purifies he who remains impure. Now, what's he referring to? What does that mean? So he makes reference to a very big, very clinical and legalistic discussion in the Talmud, which I'm not going to go through, but I'll just tell you the gist of it. Where the Talmud, in a different part, discusses different levels of impurity, right? And there are different things that you could do or couldn't do in temple times if you were at different levels of purity. So there are, for example, certain levels of impurity where mikveh is sufficient. And then there's levels of impurity where mikveh is not sufficient. You need actually spring water. Okay, mikveh today is not spring water. It's just regular rainwater, then connected with regular tap water. Right? There's a whole laws of how to build a mikveh and so on. But then there's like an upgraded level of mikveh, which is called spring water. And sometimes there's a certain waiting period. It's a whole, right? Every situation of impurity has different laws. So there's a whole discussion in the Talmud whether if a person has two kinds of impurities together, he became exposed to two different things, and he's impure on two levels. But he only has a regular mikveh available. He doesn't have a spring mikveh available, which will take care of one but not the other. Is it worth going to mikveh to get rid of the lesser impurity, even though he's still remaining pure? What's the point? Right? And the again, this is a very complicated halachic discussion. That's why I'm probably not getting the whole thing. But it doesn't matter. I just want to give you the point. Right? The point of it is that the Talmud actually suggests, yes, it's still worth it. Go to mikveh to get rid of the lesser impurity, even though at the moment you still have the other impurity with you. Right? Says the Rebbe, this is Rabbi Akiva's amazing statement. That ma mikveh, just like a mikveh, mitaher es hatmei, just like a mikveh, purifies someone who still remains impure, but nevertheless has been purified at some level. That's the way God purifies us on Yom Kippur. He says to us, I don't need you to become completely pure, but I need you to jump into a mikveh. I need you to immerse yourself in at least one step of change. Take one deficiency, take something and purify. Take one upgrade. Because, as the Rebbe explains in that talk, when you take responsibility for everything, you realize all your deficiencies. Like the person who's impure, he knows all these impurities. But you just take one mikveh, you go to one step of change towards the goal, even though you're very far from completing it. Says God, I see in that effort the potential for the whole process. I look at it as if you've started, you're on the way. And that's, on Yom Kippur, that's good for me. Right? But there's one condition. It's got to be, that one thing has to be real change. We'll talk about that in a moment. Why? Just like a mikveh. Right? And this is why there's this analogy to a mikveh. There's the laws of mikveh, even today, right? The laws of mikveh is, water is very purifying. But if you don't immerse in it completely, it doesn't work. Right? If a person goes to mikveh and there's like one hair sticking out, that's no good. It's got to be complete immersion. That's the way the halacha works. Right? So, same thing with Yom Kippur. God says, I purify even those that are just purifying one thing. But that purification has to be like a mikveh. In other words, it's got to be like a focus change, an immersive change. Not just like, by the way, yeah, okay, I'll try harder next year. I'll do, you know, once in a blue moon, I won't get angry at my spouse. Whatever, I mean, right? That's not good enough. It has to be something real. Something that you can say, I've immersed in it, I've engaged in it, I'm involved in it. Am I making sense? Are we okay? So let's break that down a little bit. So what does that mean? So I said before that after we've been inspired by the real self to make change on the conscious self, that's what the next stage is, to actually now take responsibility for the conscious self and start to fix. So God gives us 10 days of tshuva. That's known as the Aseret Yemei Tshuva. As I mentioned the other night, what's the Aseret Yemei Tshuva? Why is it 10 days? Why do we have 10 days from the beginning of the year till Yom Kippur? 10 days, of course, correspond to the 10 layers of our personality, right? As we know, we've talked about this many times. We have 10 layers of 10 powers of the soul, as we know them. And this is like sort of 10 powers of the conscious soul. So now we're looking at the conscious self more. And they are, the first three are Chochmah, Binah, Da'at, the intellectual. The second are what we call the Midot, the emotions, the six emotions, Chesed, the Gevurah, Tiferet, and so on. And then the last one is Malchut. Malchut is much more about implementation, action, behavior, thought, speech, and action. That's, I mean, obviously we've given series previously to break down each one, but this is more or less how it works. Which means that these three categories are three categories of growth, really. It's growth in our mindset, in our cognition. It's growth in our emotional structure. And of course, growth in action. Right? Now, why do we have to all three? Why do we have to look at all three? Because, you know, why not just do one thing? Because, as we said many times, growth doesn't have to be perfect. And this is what we're saying now. It's one thing, but it has to be a little bit of a push. It's like a bikkur. You've got to jump into it. Why? Because the whole idea of change and growth is to grow beyond ourselves. As I said so many times, it's exactly like fitness, right? If you just keep at the same fitness level, it's worthless, right? You might as well lie in bed. But if you do too much, you can have a heart attack, right? So it's about just a little bit more than your current fitness level. Okay, so that's what growth is. We've got to do something that is reasonable and realistic and can last and be sustainable, but it's got to be a push, right? In order for it to be a push, it's got to be something that does make us a little uncomfortable, something that's not just easy for us. A bit more than easy. It's got to be a little bit more than easy. Then it's real growth. Then it's that one mikveh, so to speak, that God's looking for, right? And therefore, we have a look at the different parts of where we need to fix, where we need to improve. It could be on the level of cognition. Maybe it's someone that, you know, studies a lot, but can study more. Or maybe someone that doesn't like studying. Good guy on the rest of it, but doesn't engage in wisdom, doesn't engage in thinking and examining and perspectives and ideas. That's maybe a place to grow in, right? And sometimes real growth means picking an area. It's good to grow in the areas that we're comfortable with and we're good at. So for example, a person who's very kind, it's good to grow to be more kind. But that's not the ultimate, because really also good to pick something where we're not so comfortable. So you have someone who's very kind, but they don't come to a shiur. Or someone that comes to lots of shiur, but is not so kind, right? It's good to pick something where we're not so good at, because it's a little bit hard. That's good. Doesn't have to be a lot, but that one push is fantastic. So we have different things. We have cognition, learning. We have midot, which is emotion, right? Now, emotion is interesting. Emotion doesn't mean, see, I want to just divide up these two things. Emotion doesn't always mean behavior. Like, kindness is not an emotion. Kindness is an action. But kindness comes from an emotion. It's the feeling of kindness, right? Why do I separate them? Because sometimes, for example, there are many people that are kind. They'll do things for other people when they know they have to. But maybe they're lacking empathy, right? Empathy is an emotion. It's about putting yourself in someone else's shoes, right? Nowadays, you've heard me say, there are studies that empathy is on the decline. Maybe that's something we need to think about. Yom Kippur. Do we notice other people that we live with? Do we notice people around us? Do we notice what they need, right? I'll just tell you a beautiful story that I came across a long, many years ago. I just recently came across it again, so I'm going to share it with you. There was a rabbi in Yerushalayim. His name was Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld. Just to give you an example of what sort of noticing, being aware of others means. Rabbi Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld was the chief rabbi of Jerusalem. This is way before the state. He was in Yerushalayim. There was already the community there, and he was the rabbi of Yerushalayim. And in his shul, it was a large shul. He was a very great rabbi. There was a chazan on Rosh Hashanah Yom Kippur. For years, he was the chazan, a beautiful chazan. He would be the one to lead the congregation. He was a very inspiring chazan. Beautiful voice, beautiful songs, stirring service, and people always loved his davening. And then one year, unfortunately, he fell ill, and a few weeks before Rosh Hashanah, I think it was, he passed away, unfortunately. So after a few days, and the funeral, the shiva, and so on, the board of the shul, I don't know if they had a board those days, but the gabayim, or whatever, the people in charge, they approached the rabbi, and they said, what do we do about a chazan? Who's your recommendation? Who do we pick? Who's the next best in the congregation, kind of thing? So Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld said, don't worry about it. It's taken care of. I'll see to it. A bit baffled, because it wasn't his job, but he was very respected, so they let it go. And they're waiting for his pronouncement of who's going to lead the praise. Doesn't happen. Comes close to Rosh Hashanah. It's a week before. It's a large congregation. They're getting a bit panicky. 2 days, one day before Rosh Hashanah, they come to him and they said, Rabbi, who's Daphne? Who's going to be the chazan tomorrow? Or in 2 days' time. He says, it's fine. Leave it to me. Comes Rosh Hashanah morning and no one knows. And you know, I'm talking about the chazan for the second part, the musaf, as we call it, the main part of Rosh Hashanah. Right? So they start the service, the regular chazan for the first part that does his job. They come to the Torah reading, they do the Torah reading, and still everyone's like plotting. Who's going to do this? Like it was a very significant position. Suddenly, just before Musaf, Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld, who hadn't told anyone, walks over to the son of the chazan, young man, who was never the chazan, and said to him, "You the chazan, go, start." Didn't give him practice, didn't give him warning. He says, "Start." He says, "Rabbi, I didn't look at it, I don't know it, I'm not that good." He says, "No, you stood next to your father for many, many, many years, I'm sure you know it. Go ahead, you daven." And the community was a little bit confused, because when someone hasn't been a chazan, and they're in the year of mourning, this is the halakha, there are circumstances, there are exceptions to this rule, but normally you don't appoint a chazan who is, unless there's a real need, for someone who's in mourning, someone who's in the year of mourning, to daven on Rosh, on Yom Tov or on Shabbos. That's the way it is, right? An avel, a mourner, doesn't daven on Shabbos, doesn't lead the service. He davens, I'm saying, for himself, but doesn't lead the services on Shabbos or Yom Tov. That's how it works. And they couldn't understand. First, they couldn't understand why he didn't tell anyone. Second of all, they didn't understand his choice, right? So someone later on after Rosh Hashanah came to me, approached him and said, "We respect your choice, but could you explain, please? Please explain." So he said, "I didn't tell anyone before because I know everyone would start arguing with me and they start challenging me halachically, and that wasn't a good idea. I didn't want it to become a whole thing. That's why I didn't tell anyone. But you want to know why I did it?" He said, "I want you to stop and think for a second. In the women's section of the shul was sitting the widow who was broken. And just imagine what would have happened in her heart when time for Musaf came and some stranger goes up to the Amud to start leading the services, and all these years she always davened with her husband leading the prayers. Just imagine what she'd feel like." So I thought to myself, the only consolation, the only comfort could be, is when the time comes, she sees her own son going over singing the tunes of his father. That could be the only comfort. That is empathy. That's empathy. When you think ahead, you notice in your mind, you're thinking, you put yourself, what are other people thinking? What are other people feeling? What are other, right? Not an act of kindness, it's an act of empathy, right? I'm mentioning this because it's a good thing to think about around this time of the year. Relationships are a very important part of Torah, even from the point of a Jewish value point of view, right? There are many different Torahs and Mitzvot, but relationships are very important. And interestingly enough, by the way, if you look at Yom Kippur davening, right? Now, don't get me wrong, I'm going to come to this soon. Right, I'm a big promoter of keeping all mitzvot. Right, anyone wants to take another mitzvah on, that's the way time to do it this year. But one should also be aware, of course, that the Torah has two parts to it. And in fact, on Yom Kippur in the Machzor, where we have the alchets, the confessions, right? If you look at them, most of them actually have to do with how we treat our fellow person. Right? Now we're supposed to add our own if we think we can, you know, in other areas, not all of them, but most of them. Or a good chunk of them, at least, have to do with how we treat another human being. Now, sometimes treating another human being is not just about what we do or don't do, it's about noticing, it's about this empathy, this idea of connecting to someone, how they feel. That's the emotional part of it, right? The emotional part of our structure. And then, of course, we have action. You know, sometimes, again, still staying in the area of between man and man, between other people. Sometimes we might be very strongly connected and even empathetic to people who we know and are close to us, but we also have to reflect on how do we treat strangers? Right? How do we treat a person that we don't know? How do we treat a waiter in the restaurant? How do we treat someone that we meet in a lift? Although nowadays you don't have to worry because they're on their phone and you're on your phone, so everyone's fine. But I'm just kidding. But right, I saw a beautiful little story also, such a nice story. I just saw it a few days ago. Of Rabbi Chaim of Brisk, another famous rabbi, lived in the town of Brisk in Europe. And he was once on a train. He lived in the 19th century. And he was traveling on a train, and two sort of well-dressed men approached him, and they didn't know who he was. He looked like just an old man, a nice old man. And they actually mistook him for a poor beggar. And they started to poke fun at him. Right? Poke fun. They started to make fun of him. Then, eventually, he didn't say anything. And then the train arrived, listen to the story, it's such an amazing thing. And then the train arrived in Brisk. And they realized they made a mega mistake, right? Everyone came out to meet him, they could see the students, how he was respected. They saw, we completely misread this one, right? And they felt really, really bad. And they came over to him and they said, "We are terribly, terribly sorry. We plead for your forgiveness." Now you have to understand, Reb Chaim of Brisk was a person who is, we forgive freely. I mean, he was an unbelievable person. They say about him that people used to come sleep at his, like he would be so kind. People would come sleep at his home at night. They wouldn't even know he was there. Anyone who needed a place, they just came and they slept on the floor, on the couch, everywhere. Like, didn't make a difference. So he wasn't, it wasn't that he was like ego absorbed at all. Nevertheless, he said, I can't forgive you. I can't forgive you. So they were taken aback. I mean, we know this time of the year is the time you're supposed to ask forgiveness if you have to. And it says in the Shulchan Aruch, it says in the Code of Jewish Law, before Yom Kippur, if you've wronged someone, you should ask for forgiveness. And it says the person who's being asked for forgiveness shouldn't be cruel. He should give forgiveness, or she should give forgiveness, right? So it's a two-way street, so it's a big thing. Why did he give forgiveness? Look what he said to them. He explained, I'll read it to you the way I saw this in the story. So he explained that it was forbidden to him to forgive, since the person they had harassed was not the same person they were asking forgiveness from. They had offended a poor beggar. And now they have to find such a man to seek his forgiveness. That's an amazing story. That's what I share with you, because it's such a beautiful story before Yom Kippur, right? In other words, well, you come in to ask forgiveness because you realize I'm Reb Chaim of Brisk. That's why you're asking for forgiveness. The you thought you were harassing a poor beggar. That is terrible. To harass a poor beggar is a terrible thing to do. But now you're coming to ask forgiveness because you think I'm someone else. No, I can't forgive you. You've got to ask that person forgiveness. Maybe eventually you did forgive them, but I guess it was just a way of sending a message. Right? You want them to reflect on what they'd really done. The sin wasn't that they offended Reb Chaim of Brisk. The sin was that they'd offended a poor, simple beggar. That was the sin, right? So these are things. You know, there's just, I mean, there are many, many things, of course, in terms of jealousy, anger, indulgence, all these things that have to do with the way we behave and the way we think. Some of them are more action-based, some of them are more emotional-based. That's why we have the 10 days of Tshuva, because it's a symbol of the different layers of our personality and some of the things that we can improve on the different layers. But of course, as we always say, it's also a good time to look at not just the way our relationships with other people, although it's critical. It's also a time to look at our relationship with God. As we know, the Torah is divided into two parts, right? Between man and man, between man and God. It's time to look at the things that we can upgrade. Now again, not to be perfect. None of us are perfect. We all have a long way to go. But maybe it's a time to think about a mitzvah that's hard for us and to take it upon, at least to do it sometimes, right? Even a small mitzvah, something like Shabbat candles, but Shabbat candles that need to be lit on time, of course, not early, or not too early, not too late, right? Especially after dark, that undermines the whole Shabbat candles. Whatever it is, a direction, I'm just throwing out a couple of examples to make it practical, right? People have mezuzahs on the door to make sure they're kosher. If they have mezuzahs only on one door, maybe to add another one on another door, because really it should be on all doors, but maybe one more mezuzah this year, right? All these different things, stepping towards a kashrut, whatever the mitzvah is. And for some people, this is a real push, just like for some people, improving their relationships is a real push, right? Some people, the mitzvot are easier than others, but their relationship with other people needs work. Some people, it's the other way around. They're good at improving on relationship with others, but their mitzvot keeping is difficult. So we find those areas where we can pick something realistic and reasonable and sustainable, but nevertheless a push. And sometimes the push is specifically in the area where I'm not so comfortable, or things maybe I don't understand, or I don't relate to, right? You've heard me say this many times. This is the plague of our society, that we only do things that resonate with us. I love that word, resonate. Resonate. It's nonsense. You do something because, right? You do something because it's right, not because it resonates. It's good to resonate if you can, but if it doesn't, do it anyway. That's part of growth. See, if I only do things that resonate, that means I'm stuck in me. Because it has to resonate with who? With me. Maybe it resonates with you, but not me. But so I'm me, so I get stuck in me. Right? Real growth is when I do things even though they don't resonate. I just know they're right. I know it's a good thing to do. That's why I do it. That's real growth. So we have to chuck out resonate from the dictionary and start growing. Right? So the point is this. The point is like this. How do we do all this? The point is, as I said, let's just summarize. Rosh Hashanah is when we reveal the ability to grow, because we reveal the real self, right? And at that point, as we know, just in the Rosh Hashanah point of the journey, the real self and the conscious self are not aligned. They actually are at odds with each other. The real self is pure. The conscious self has done some good things, but done some mistakes, right? So the 10 days of tshuva really is about aligning the conscious self with the real self. Not perfectly, but as I said, that mikvah theory is to just take one step. That's an alignment because you've started the process, right? But it needs a conscious plan. It needs a real plan, right? So we So we do a couple of things in these areas that we want to improve in. First of all, we think about the past, and we think about how we didn't do them till now. Maybe I didn't treat people right till now. Maybe I didn't do this mitzvah. Whatever the case is, I think about what I have, the mistake that I may have made, or the area of improvement that I need. And we learn from the past. This is an important part. See, we learn from the past, because part of tshuva is not just to stop doing the things we're doing to improve, but it's actually to elevate the past, even the negative past. Because this is the greatness of tshuva. We need to take that past that we're trying to improve and bring it along with us and make it a catalyst for the real change. So we learn, like, why didn't I do it? Or what was wrong? Or what triggered me to mistreat another person? Or whatever the case is. And by learning from it, we do it better in the future. So we learn the past. We learn from the past. As I said, we don't let the past define us. We don't let the past get us stuck. But we do let the past teach us. That's an important thing to do. Because the past is important, because everything has potential. Even negative past has something good in it that could teach us. I saw a beautiful idea recently that, you know, the word for transgression in Hebrew is chet. Chet, tet, aleph. Chet, tet, aleph. Chet. That's why in Yom Kippur we say the al chet, right? Because we talk about the transgressions that we might have done, right? So chet is three letters. Chet, tet, aleph. But the aleph is very silent. You don't hear the aleph. Right? It's just a consonant at the end. You could really just write the word just chet, tet, and it would say the same thing. Chet. Right? Ch and te is chet. The aleph, you don't hear at all. It's just very completely silent. What's the idea? So the chet and the tet is the transgression, the negativity, the weaknesses of the past. Aleph is always a symbol of God. But God is even in our negative things. God is even there in our transgression. It's just silent. It's hidden. Right? When you do a mitzvah, when you do a good thing, God is revealed. When you do a bad thing, God is not revealed, but He's there. Because even the negative, even the past that we're not so proud of sometimes, has godliness in it because it could teach us to do a better future. So that's part of the process. We identify the areas of growth. We learn from the past. And then, of course, we make a practical, reasonable resolution, right? And that's an important thing to do. And these two things, it's hard how they come together. We need to say, I'm going to take upon myself something. I'm going to improve in an area or two areas or three areas, whatever the case is. I'm going to choose things that is a push. That might be push me a little bit beyond my comfort zone. But at the same time, it's got to be realistic. Now, that's a hard thing to marry up. A push, but realistic. Because we know that sometimes, this is a well-known documented thing, not only in Judaism, it's well-known every time there's a new milestone, there's a lot of literature around the 1st of January about New Year resolutions that don't work. Because people get excited, people get fresh, people get thinking, oh, I'm going to do this and this and this. It doesn't work because it's not sustainable. So it's got to be a push, but it's also got to be reasonable. It's got to be something you know that you can do and something that you can hopefully hold on to, right? And then, this is part of learning from the past, really, we have to set it up for success, right? Set it up for success means we have to think about it, we have to learn. So for example, take a thing about getting less angry or treating people better, right? So we can't just say, I'm going to do it better, or even just a small thing. You know, I'm going to be nicer to my children, or whatever the case is, right? One has to learn it, but you have to set it. But what's going to change? Like, you didn't do it last year, so why are you going to change now? I know you've thought about it, and you must change, and it's important to improve, and you want to push yourself, and you have a conscious self and a real self. It's all good, but what is going to change on the ground? You know, it's like, say, you know, people read parenting books, and then they go home, and the kid pushes their buttons, and all the parenting books go out the window, right? They're all fired up, so what happened? So it needs constant learning. Like, if it's an area you want to grow in, you need to learn about that area. If it's a mitzvah you want to take upon, it's important to learn about that mitzvah. So you become excited about it, and you become driven about it, and you become passionate about it, right? And you remember it, and you've got to revisit that, because don't forget, we have an ego. So as much as we, around Elul and Tishrei, decide that something is really important to grow in, it in Hanukkah time, it might not be the same, because I've forgotten about it, I'm not so inspired like I was then. So it means I have to take upon the area and I have to say, you know, I'm going to, the whole year, once a week, I'm going to read up about this concept. Whether it's jealousy, whether it's anger, whether it's hatred, whether it's empathy, whatever, whether it's a mitzvah, whatever the area is, it's got to be something that we're going to keep connected to, we're going to keep learning, right? There also might be triggers, there might be things that set us up, right? It could be a practical thing. There was a guy out here, many, many years ago, I brought up the guy, a rabbi in Israel, does a lot of marriage counseling. So I remember just the one line, it was very cute. And just a very practical thing, but the practical thing was a bit silly, but I mean, not silly actually, but it was just a little thing. But it brought out a concept, right? Sometimes we do things and we can avoid doing them if we just set ourselves up for success. So his line was that men are very dangerous when they're hungry. right? So he says sometimes they come after a whole day's work, and let's say the woman is taking care of kids and family, whatever the case is, and she's also had a tough day, which men often don't realize that, you know, taking care of a bunch of kids and household chores and things like that is just as grueling, right? More grueling. It's more difficult. One of the ways my wife taught me that is by she went away for a few days and left me with a thing, right? Just kidding. But so he said, he was talking to men. He said, can I ask you all a favor? You come down after a holiday. He says, have in your briefcase an apple. Don't go into the house. Stay in the car and eat an apple. So you don't come in starving. You're dangerous when you're starving, right? Why do I like that? Because I don't know if that applies to everyone, but I'm just saying it's a concept. If you know that when you're irritable, you get angry and you become nasty, so avoid being irritable. Right? In other words, that's part of learning from the past on a very practical level.
They call it angry and hungry.
Angry and hungry, right. But actually sometimes a lot of the angry becomes because of hungry, right? That's right. So don't walk in starving. You'll enjoy the dinner anyway, but just like, you know, just eat something so you're not starving. Right? I'm saying a lot of times we know that there are certain areas where we fail more than others. And that's part of reflection, part of learning to understand, you know, what it is that we're doing, right? And what sets us up. So part of the practical plan for improvement is identifying what are the areas that will make it easier for me, basically to set ourselves up for success, right? So let's now go back to how this all ends. Well, not ends, I'm saying what the climax of this is. So this is like what the 10 days of Tshuva represent. Then we come to Yom Kippur. That's the 10th day. So Yom Kippur is where we stand there in front of God. We apologize for whatever happened during the past year. God forgives us without a question. Blesses us with amazing things. And we demonstrate that one little thing, that two little things, that we're going to prove in the coming year. And then we do that throughout Yom Kippur. That's Yom Kippur is ready to the day to solidify that. And then as we move through Yom Kippur, we come to the very end, and we know that the holiest time of Yom Kippur is the time of Ne'ilah, right? Ne'ilah is that last prayer, that fifth prayer, where we blow the shofar at the end, we scream out Shema Yisrael, the gates close, and so on. So the Kabbalists explain, I think I've mentioned this before, what's the idea of Ne'ilah? So we know that we've said this many times, there are five layers of the soul, right? Three conscious layers, that's the corresponds to the ten to the three sections of the ten powers. We have our subconscious, which is still part of us, and then we have the fifth layer, which is that spark. The fifth layer is what we've been talking about the whole time when we talk about the real self. That's the fifth layer of the soul. That's in Yiddish we call it the pintalayid, right? The spark that's always there. On Yom Kippur, what we do at the end of Yom Kippur is we circle back and reconnect once again to that core self. Which means, Rosh Hashanah, we do it through the shofar, then we actually kind of almost move away from there, inspired by the real self, and for the 10 days work on our conscious self, and then kind of come back to the real self. Why do we do that? That's what's so powerful about Ne'ilah. Because when we come back to the real self at the end of Yom Kippur, it's a different real self, so to speak, than the shofar one. Why? What I mean by that is, when we expose the real self on Rosh Hashanah, showing that it's different to our conscious self, and that conscious self, which is the messy stuff, doesn't define us, but it's our real self that defines us, and then we're going to try work on our conscious self. So at that point, the real self is exposed, but as I said, it's not aligned at all with the conscious self. By taking a step forward, by starting to patch up and starting to improve the failings or the mistakes of the conscious self, even if it's not perfect, this is the point, even if it's not perfect, but it's the mikveh, we purified. Because it's one thing, we've taken a step in the right direction. By doing that and by working that through the 10 days of tshuva, we elevate the whole conscious self, where at the end of Yom Kippur, it's the time of complete alignment with the conscious self and the real self. And that's why Ne'ilah is the fifth prayer together with all the other prayers. It's number five, but it comes together with all the first four. It's that time of extreme, we call in Kabbalah, the extreme oneness. It's a real moment of oneness where every part of us is aligned. In other words, our conscious self is now completely aligned with the real self. Yeah, does that make sense? Why? What does that mean, aligned? And why, what's it got to do with oneness? And also, what's it got to do with the fact that we scream out Shema Yisrael at the end of Ne'ilah? Because Shema Yisrael is about the oneness of God, right? Now we know that the oneness of God is not just about that there's one God, right? The mystics teach us that when we say every day Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad, it's not just that there's one God and not other gods, or there's not two gods, there's only one God. But really, that God's oneness is something that permeates the entire creation. What does that mean? So what happens in the creation happens within us as well. When God created the world, He created a very fragmented world, right? Completely fragmented world. A world of fragmentation, a world of multiplicity. But the purpose of, and everything's different. The tree's different to the animal, each animal's different, each blade of grass is different, each fingerprint is different, everything's different. Each person is different. We're all different. We're all sort of running in different directions. And yet, we're all supposed to return and be part of one mission, one core, one belief, right? So in other words, the idea of oneness is that it's a fragmented world, a very different world, but our job is to create a oneness in the world. How do you do that? Because the world in its fragmented state can be a world of complete oneness and stillness and calmness, because it can, if we take all the fragmentations and we allow them to be focused on one value system, on one faith system, on one belief, on one purpose, on one mission, they remain different, but they all focus on the same thing. On bringing godliness into the world, bringing purity in the world, bringing improvement into the world. And then it becomes oneness. So now you know, it's interesting that when we say Hashem Echad, God is one, what's the word Echad in Hebrew? It's Aleph Chet Dalet. So again, once again, Aleph is one, the one God. Chet is eight, which the Kabbalah says and the Code of Jewish Law tells us refers to the seven heavens and the earth, that's eight. And Dalet is four, the four directions of the world, north, east, south, west, right? Which is the Chet and the Dalet is more about the fragmentation of the world. Seven heavens, four directions, and so on. When we say Echad with Hashem Echad, we talk about bringing that oneness of God into the Chet and the Dalet, that God then directs and inspires the Chet and the Dalet, the eight and the four, so that this becomes a symbol of oneness in the entire thing. Right? Yeah. Yeah, so it's in the Talmud that God has, there's seven heavens before the earth. They're spiritual things, really. Not, I don't know if they're physical seven heavens, but there's a concept of seven heavens, and each heaven has a different idea behind it. Yeah. You're right. I probably haven't referred to it. Thank you. I just skipped it over very quickly, right? But yeah, it's a concept of seven heavens. Yeah. Right. Now the same thing happens within us, really. The God within us, the spark of godliness within us, is that core self. It's the part of us that spark, that the real self that's connected to God, right? And then we have our conscious self. Our conscious self is fragmented, right? It's got different personalities, got different issues, different priorities, different things pulling us. The conscious self can be very fragmented, which is why there's so much stress today, because everyone is running in different directions. People are pulled. People are, I don't know what to do today. I've got this meeting. I've got this thing. I've got that thing. They're running because they're always running after stuff, right? As we know, especially in our world. What's missing in many people's lives is the spirit of oneness, because we're working as we've met many times. We're working outside in. We're letting everything in the fragmented world direct what we're supposed to be doing. And we're pulled in everything. We're pulled in all directions. What we need to do, of course, is align that conscious self with our real self and let the real self, the God in us, direct. Bring everything together. And that's Ne'ilah. Ne'ilah is when the conscious self and the conscious self and the real self become aligned, and there's that spirit of oneness, the oneness of God and the oneness therefore within ourselves, and that's where we end Yom Kippur. We scream out the Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad. It's a bit late, so I'm going to leave it there. But I did want to bring this out a bit different way. Maybe I'll just do it at the beginning of next week. But again, we have one more week. But next week, what we're going to do is we're going to add one more very important component to this whole journey, which is critical. And that's the lessons from the Festival of Sukkot. Because the journey of Elul, Rosh Hashanah, and Yom Kippur doesn't end with Yom Kippur. It ends with Simchat Torah. And that's what we need to understand. What's the component? What's the next part? What's the ingredient that Sukkot brings to the table, and we'll deal with that next week. Please God, and end of the series. Have a wonderful day.